Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls.
Well, morning. Our question from Jesus this morning comes from John chapter 11. John chapter 11, and this is, of course, prior to Jesus going into Jerusalem for the last time, but his time is growing near, and the opposition is mounting against him. And in John chapter 11 and verse 7, we read these words, John 11 and verse 7. Then after this, he said to his disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again?" And Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of the world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him." And our question, of course, are there not 12 hours in the day? And there are a couple of things about that. One, when you ask a simple question like that, there's usually something much deeper behind it. Students don't always recognize that when you ask them a straightforward question, but there's usually something behind it when Jesus asks a question, that's for sure. And what is exactly the point that he's trying to make to them here? Well, we might quibble whether it's a simple question or not. 12 hours in the day. Let's see, you know, the sun gets bright enough where you can see about 6:30. You can still see at 8:30. So that's like about 14 hours of daylight. Maybe we should say 24 hours in a day, 14 hours in a day. Well, obviously we recognize what Jesus' point is here. Their day is divided into the day and night, and they're almost equal if we average it out over the course of the entire year. And if we are at a moderate latitude, then we're going to have 12 hours a day, 12 hours a night approximately. And that's the point. The daytime is the time for doing things. The nighttime is the time in which we are unable to do things. We're all confused, the world in which we live, because we have artificial light. So we can work and stay up, in the middle of the night all the way into the early wee hours of the morning. Then we can draw the blinds and sleep during the daytime. But generally, it is going to be clear you need to use the day for working, and the night is a time in which you can't work. That certainly was true for them. And Jesus' point here is what exactly? They say to him, "Are you going into Judea? They were just trying to kill you there." And he says, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? Are there not 12 hours in the day? It may be the 11th hour," he is saying to them, "but there's still 12 hours in the day. It may be almost to the point at which I'm not going to be able to work, but there's still time for work to be done." And Jesus' point is, I'm going to continue to work, even in the limited amount of time that I have left. Because I know the time is coming when I'll not be able to walk at all. I'll not be able to work in your behalf in this way anymore. But I'm going to take advantage of the time that I have available. And so he is saying something not just about his own behavior, his own attitude, but he's saying something to the disciples about what will be true of them and what is true of us as well. So there are four lessons, I think, here in this comment that Jesus makes, this question. And I want to say a little bit about each one of those. First lesson is there's only 12 hours in a day, so don't waste the little time you have. There's only a certain amount of time to get things done. It may seem like when you get up in the morning that it is an endless day. I vaguely can remember when I was young enough to think that was the case. Now I know better. It may seem when you're at the beginning of the road, that it is a long, long, indefinite process till you come to the end. But as Joe and I were talking just before services, at this point in our life, you recognize there's a lot less time available than there was before. So don't waste that time. Second lesson is, there are 12 hours in the day, not just 10 or 11. So it doesn't matter whether you're at the 11th hour of the day, whether you're at the 11th hour of your life. You don't quit until you've reached the end. You continue to take advantage of the time that you have. The day will end. So third lesson, you need to do something. You need to use the time that you have. You need to do something with the opportunities that are yours. Because lesson four, the night is coming, and when the night comes, there's not going to be time to do things. It's not going to be easy to do things when the day is over. That's what Jesus says. When you walk in the light, you won't stumble, but when the night comes and you try and walk, then you're going to stumble. So we have these four lessons. Lesson one, then, don't waste time, because there's only a limited amount of time. And when I do this for my students at the beginning of the school year, I ask them how many hours in a day, how many days in the week, how many weeks in the semester. Let's multiply that out. How many hours are you going to put into studying, and how many hours are you going to put into sleeping? We do all of that, and you could do those things for yourself as well. But the point here is to say whether you count 12 hours or 14 hours of daylight or 24 hours in the day, as if you could use all 24 of those without sleeping some of them. The point is there's only so much time, and there are a lot of things to do, and only so much time to do them. And you can't make more time. There is no way to make more time. You can while away the time. You can waste the time. You can even kill the time, but you cannot make more time. And the best we can do is to use the time that we have available to us. That's what Paul is talking about in Ephesians chapter 5. Familiar passage. All the time management experts are going to go to this passage, Ephesians chapter 5, and in verse 15, the Apostle Paul says, "See that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time because the days are evil." Redeeming the time. And of course, when you think about redeeming, we understand that to mean buy back. And that seems to contradict what we were just thinking about. You can't make any more time. You can't buy any more time. Oh boy, if we could buy any time. It's like, I'll give you $500 for another hour. If it was a particular hour, I'll give you $1,000 for that hour to get that one back. I don't think we can do that. That's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about using the time wisely, as will be the way in most of the more modern translations of phrasing this. Use the time wisely. Use it up. You have this chip, this hour, and you lay it down on the table and you get something worthwhile out of it. Make sure that you've done something useful with this 1 hour. Use it wisely. Buy up the opportunities. That's the expression in some of the translations. And how do you buy opportunities? Well, you buy opportunities the same way you buy anything else on a limited budget. You count the money in your pocket, you look at the options in front of you, and you pick out the one that's going to give you the most bang for the buck. You get the thing that is going to be most useful to you. At least we'd like to think we make those kind of wise decisions with our money, but do we make those kind of wise decisions with our time? We have a limited amount of time. Opportunities, let's get the opportunities that are going to be the most benefit for us. And something that's going to take a lot of time, we have to say, now wait a minute, is this the best opportunity? Is this the best investment of my time? We need to get the best deal we can for the limited amount of time that we have. Use the time that you have because it is limited. And the second lesson Jesus is making here is you need to use the hours that you have and not stop too soon. You got to work right up to the bell. You got to play to the last whistle. You can't stop until it's all over. And my son Jason's been watching soccer. Well, there are a couple of reasons for that. I don't understand it, but the big reason is no commercials. So it's like, I can understand that. Yeah. And not many timeouts, unless they're dragging somebody off of the field on a stretcher. But one of the things about soccer is you say, you know, we got this 90 minutes, and then they count it down, and then all of a sudden they've got another 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes that the referees add on because of the time they drug the people off on the stretchers. So you got to keep playing because you can't stop until they blow the whistle. Otherwise, you may very well lose that game. Jesus says that about himself. Look, I know it's the 11th hour. I know that they're pressing in on me, but I'm still going to do the work that the Father has sent for me to do. There is time yet. That's the thought that's in Anna Coghill's hymn that we sing sometimes. At least we used to sing this one a lot, didn't we, Donnie? Work, for the night is coming. Work through the morning hours. Work while the dew is sparkling. Work mid springing flowers. Work when the day grows brighter. Work in the glowing sun. Work, for the night is coming when man's work is done. You don't lay down and quit until the day is over. That'll be the time for stopping. We've got to treat our lives in the same way that Jesus did his. We need to keep working right up to the last minute, right up to the bell, right up to the finish line. And that's the point in Hebrews chapter 12, where the writer there is suggesting to those Hebrews Christians, you can't quit yet. The finish line isn't here. It's over there. You've got to keep going until you get to that finish line, until you cross the finish line. We have so many reasons to do that. We have, of course, the great cloud of witness, he says. You just look and see in chapter 11 and all of those that he recounted and the myriad of others who pressed through to the end. We need to recognize that's true of our own lives, that necessity to press right on through. And most of all, Jesus. Jesus, who said, are there not 12 hours in the day? We're going to keep working as long as it is day. We need to fix our eyes on Jesus, who is the perfecter of our faith, he says, the finisher of our faith. And he didn't quit. Right on through the cross, the full 12 hours he worked. But the danger is for us, as it was for the Hebrews, that we'll stop short of the finish line. And what have we accomplished at that point? I'm reminded as I think about that of two or three familiar scenes from usually the Olympics, because those are where the eyes of the world are focused on the track and field events and the racers, you know, and they stumble into the stadium and everybody else has already crossed the finish line and they stagger around the track, but they finish the race. They're determined they're going to finish. Doesn't seem like it means much to others, but it is important to them. We need to finish the race. But it is a common problem for people to stop short, and it doesn't matter how close you got. If you don't cross the finish line, it doesn't count. It was a problem for the Hebrew Christians. They were giving up. It was a problem for the Galatians. Paul wrote to them in Galatians chapter 5 and verse 7, and he's marveling at what they have done. Galatians 5 and verse 7, you were running well. Who hindered you from obeying the gospel? Who stopped you? Well, and of course, we might make all kinds of suggestions about who stopped them, whether it was Satan ultimately, whether it was their friends, whether it was their business affiliates, whether it was their enemies in this world, whether it was their own weak will, but it doesn't matter. They didn't cross the finish line, and he's amazed about that. There are 12 hours in the day. Don't quit at the 10th hour or even the 11th hour. Jesus certainly didn't. Some people think, over the course of their life, that they can retire. And blessed are those who are able to lay down and enjoy the sunset years. Whatever they do with those sunset years, I don't know. But if they do, then that's great. But you can't retire from the Lord's work. There's no mention in the Bible of a retirement plan, unless, of course, it is as this sampler a lady gave me at a congregation years ago says, the Lord's retirement plan is out of this world. Because that's where our retirement is as Christians, not in this life, not while it is still daylight. It is after this life is over. John chapter 9 and verse 4, Jesus teaches the same lesson that he taught in John chapter 11. John chapter 9 and verse 4, we must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no man can work. We need to finish the course. We need to do like the Apostle Paul when he writes in 2 Timothy and says, I have run the race. I have finished the course. I've gotten to the end now. He didn't stop before when he was in prison the first time. He didn't stop when they let him out. That's why they put him in prison apparently the second time. He is going to finish the course. But to do that, he said in Hebrews, or the writer says in Hebrews chapter 12, the writer says you got to get rid of two things if you're going to finish the course. You got to get rid of the sins that encumber us. Well, that's pretty obvious. You got to get rid of the sins. But he goes on to say not just the sins, but the weights as well. Not just sins, but weights. And what are those? What are those that hold us back from finishing? Well, they don't seem to be exactly like sins. In fact, they may be pretty good things, but they interfere with our ability to finish the course, to do the work that is set before us. To paraphrase Voltaire, as many people do, the enemy of the best is the good. People substitute something that's seemingly okay for that which would have been better to have spent their limited time on, to have bought the best opportunity. In Luke chapter 10, for instance, we have Martha and Mary. And Martha is chiding her sister Mary for not helping her prepare the meal. And she goes to Jesus in righteous indignation and she says, Mary's not helping. This is the work we need to be doing. But Jesus in turn reprimands her and says, Mary has chosen the better part. And of course, the cooking and the cleaning has to be done, but those are not the most important things in life. We need to shift our perspective, get our priorities right, so that we can redeem the time and do the most important things. We need to set the priorities about that. And of course, there are so many ways in which we get caught up in the little bitty things of life that seem monumentally important to us. That's one of my character flaws, is getting so focused on the little things that I am determined I'm going to finish this. It's like, I was in the cabinet last night and I was searching around for something and my wife says, what are you looking for? Maybe I can help you. I said, no, I decided I was going to look for it and I'm going to keep looking until I find it. I'm not going to take any help. I'm not going to quit. I'm going to keep looking until I find it. And that's going to get in the way of doing other things that we could do if, in fact, we get focused on things that are less important and quit paying attention to the things that are most important. We need to shift our perspective and do the best things as opposed to just good things in our life. And that means, of course, ultimately for those of us who are Christians, focusing on spiritual growth and spiritual things. And there comes lesson number three, do something. Do something. Don't just be idle, do something. Of course, the Bible's filled with admonitions about the sluggard and what happens to the sluggard. And the sluggard is the one who is going to end up in poverty. Proverbs 24 and verse 30. And of course, I don't have any idea exactly how they compile the Proverbs or who was the first person to write these down, but I'm pretty sure a lot of people over the years, like I myself and probably you, have read these things and kind of snickered a little bit, laughed at this sluggard. Seems like the person who wrote these down was really mocking him, but Proverbs 24 and verse 30, I passed by the field of the sluggard, by the vineyard of the man lacking sense, and behold, it was completely overgrown with thistles. Its surface was covered with nettles. Its stone wall was broken down. When I saw, I reflected upon it. I looked and I received some instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and then your poverty will come as a robber. And you want like an armed man. You need to be busy about doing something. And I've told you this story before, but it resonates in my mind. My dad would leave my brother, me, on a job to do something, and of course sometimes the materials aren't exactly right, You know, there are only four penny nails, not three penny nails, or, you know, there's crown molding, and when there should have been quarter round, and who knows what it is. But there's always an excuse. And I have this online class that I teach every summer, and I always know this is the way it's going to work. You tell the students in explicit instructions as you possibly can about what they're supposed to do, when they're supposed to post, how many words they're supposed to post, on what page where they're supposed to post. But if you don't give them exactly the right information, it's like, I don't know, can't do anything. I gave them all these careful, explicit instructions, and then I mistitled one page. Oh, can't do anything. I can't. And my dad would come back, and my brother, they would just sit there, say, we can't do anything. And he would say, son, just do something. Even if it's wrong, just do something. And I want to say to my students, just post something somewhere on some page, and at least you can say, I tried. Be active. Do something. That's the advice, really, of the king in Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 10. Solomon, the wise man, writes in Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. And, of course, he makes the same point, too. There's no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you're going. You got a limited amount of time. Do something and do it as hard as you can. Do it well. Be active. God intended for people to be active from the very beginning. In Genesis chapter 2 and in verse 15, in the idyllic Garden of Eden, where everything was just the way that it was supposed to be, the fruit was always ripe. In Genesis chapter 2 and verse 15, the Lord God took the man and he put him in the Garden of Eden. But you got to read the rest of that sentence. He put him in the Garden of Eden to cultivate it and to keep it. Yes, even in the Garden of Eden, God intended for people to be busy. There were things for them to do. I can't imagine what it would have been like to be in the Garden of Eden and everything that you did worked out okay. Because that's not the way it is in the world today. But that would have been great. But we need to be busy. God intended for us to be busy. And, of course, some people are and some people aren't. That's one of those kind of common expressions in the world of work, in businesses. Fifth of the people do 80% of the work. And that's just the way it happens. And if you go into a workplace, you need to know that. And you can be, you know, one of the 20% of the people to do 80% of the work. Or you can be part of the mass group that just does a little bit. You can make your decision about that. It's not quite so humorous when we talk about that in terms of congregations, but the same thing is probably true in terms of congregations. Many congregations have had, this admonition. A third of it is a willing congregation. A third of the people are willing to work, and two-thirds are willing to let them work. But we need to be busy. We are Christians, and we need to redeem the time and buy up the opportunities. In our own personal lives, one of the expressions that just comes up over and over and over again from one generation to the next, and that is when you get further down the road, you get to the end of the day, you get to the end of the year, you get to the end of the period of your life, you get toward the end of your life, what you regret are the times that you missed, the opportunities that you missed out on. You can be so obsessive and perfectionistic about things and spend so much time on perfecting trivial, unimportant activities that you miss the big opportunities. You miss the time with your children. You miss the time with your relationships. You miss out on the important things in life. And you know what could be worse than doing nothing at all? Doing things that are really worth nothing at all. And person who's doing nothing, sometimes you can really appeal to them. You can say, look, you're doing nothing. And it's like fairly obvious they're doing nothing. But then you say to some other people, what you're doing is worse than nothing because it's worth nothing. And it's like, I don't get that. I don't understand. I'm busy every day. I'm hard at work. I'm just working my fingers to the bone. But you're not doing the right kind of things. You're not doing the most important kind of things. And I can guarantee you this is one of Satan's best techniques. is to get us to substitute something that is less important for that which is most important. Because then we can rationalize that we're busy, that we're doing what we ought to be doing. But we need to be doing the right kind of things. We need to be walking in the light, Jesus says. Walking in the light, because when you walk in the light, when you walk in the light of Jesus and His way of doing things, you don't stumble. You get out of the light, that's where you're going to stumble. And even Paul says in that passage in Ephesians chapter 5 where he talks about redeeming the time, he says, because the days are evil. The days are evil and the night is coming when it is going to be even worse. And then it's going to be even harder to do the good things. In Ephesus, where Paul is writing, they are prosperous. It's one of the most prosperous periods of time in the history of the Roman Empire. And of course, we look back and, you know, it's trivial compared to the kind of prosperity that we enjoy today. But the kind of commercial success that they had was accompanied by godlessness. There's a pride in prosperity. There is a kind of pride that sets itself against God in prosperity. And you can see that not just in Ephesus and Corinth in those days, but you can see it in America today. People are oh so cultured and refined, but they don't have the most basic concept of wholesomeness and integrity and morality. They will quibble about all kinds of points of the law, all kinds of issues about whose moral compass is stronger than who else's moral compassness is, but they just do not have a common sense of morality because they are godless. Godless in the plain fundamental sense of they are without God. It's not necessarily that they intend to be evil or they intend to be wicked, but they are godless. They are without God. They don't have time for that. But this kind of an evil environment, this kind of evil, prosperous, godless society provides an opportunity, provides plenty of opportunity for teaching other people. If nothing else, the godly man's life stands out even more in that kind of environment than it would otherwise. You don't really have to talk about religion or force people to talk about it. You don't have to put a religious tract in every letter that you write or say praise the Lord in every sentence that you say, but godly character should be represented in every action we take and in every dealing we have with other people. And so people will ultimately say, well, you can trust that man. You may not like him. You may not want to invite him to your parties, but you can trust him with your money. You can trust him with your secrets because that man is a Christian. And that's always the occasion. You know, when things are really down and out for people, they want to find somebody they can trust. They want to find somebody they can ask whose advice they actually respect. And not just some other godless person like themselves. We're not called to come out of the world. We're called to live as Christ in the world. Jesus' last prayer in John chapter 19 was about that. John chapter 19 and verse 15, he's praying to God. And he says, I don't pray that you take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one. We need to represent Christ in the world and shine his light in the corner in which we live as well as we can. Everything that we do ought to shine forth as the light of Jesus Christ in this world. And the unrest of this present world provides an opportunity for showing the peace that comes from knowing Jesus Christ. If we could just to some small degree, like Jesus, bring the peace of God into the room in which we enter, we would have done a great thing. We would have bought up the opportunity that was available to us. We need to invest in the right kind of opportunities in our lives. And how do we know what the right kind of opportunities are? Well, it's pretty obvious to most of us. The problem is we're distracted. We don't think about it. There's a business couple that were one of those like power couples and had their own couple of businesses and their own brand. And they were busy here and busy there. And they had three children. And they had fancy house and fancy cars. And they had all kinds of things. But they knew there was something missing, and they sat down and talked about it one evening. And they said, how are we going to get our priorities right? And they had read this time management book, and the guy had suggested in there, you should ask yourself, what is your life going to look like on the other side of the funeral when you look back, if you could? What would it look like? Who's going to come to your funeral? And they thought about that. Who's going to come to our funeral? Who is going to be there that is going to be remorseful that we've gone? Won't be our business partners. They're going to be back in the office trying to ferret out who's going to get what. Who's going to be at the funeral? And they decided on the basis of that, that's who we're going to invest our time in. We're going to invest our time in those people. That's the opportunity that's before us. That's what we need to use the coin of time to redeem. Those kind of opportunities. And you think about that, that's really kind of a significant change in the priorities we have. In whom should we invest our time? We should invest our time in our families. We should invest our time in our spouse. I mean, some people live with this kind of constant myth that, you know, marriage is bound to become kind of routine, dull, and even just kind of a, you know, go to neutral corners sort of arrangement. But that's not that's not necessarily the case. You can have a mediocre relationship if you want to, but marriage, like any other relationship, is a plant that needs constant kind of nourishment and attention. We need to invest in one another because that's what makes our lives worthwhile. Jerry Clower used to say in a negative way, if mama ain't happy, nobody ain't happy. But put it in a positive way, you know, that's what makes us happy when the people that are closest and most important to us are happy. And that's up to us in some way. One man turned and pointed to his wife, who was laughing and carefree and, you know, full of self-confidence. He said, I made her that way. And maybe in some ways that's probably true. We make one another because of the constant time that we spend in the family together. And what a much better way to say, you know, I made her that way when she's happy and carefree. And they look at her over there, you know, depressed and upset and say, I made her that way. Because it's going to come back on you either way. Anything you invest in your family, anything you invest in your spouse is actually going to come back to you. Those are the opportunities we need to buy up. And we need to invest ourselves in our children if we have children and still have an opportunity to invest in them. Because no time with a child is ever wasted. Politician said in his address to his campaign headquarters after he had lost the election, he said to them, I want to thank you, my dedicated campaign workers. I want to thank you for your efforts. I wanted you to know that I am actually glad that I lost this race because now I can do what I really wanted to do all along and spend more time with my family. Well, you don't hear many of them saying that, but some of them, it may be the best thing that ever happened to them. We need to spend time with our children and invest in them. There was an advertisement in a newspaper a number of years ago talking about child care, and the advertisement kind of struck me as ironic. The advertisement for this particular kind of daycare center said, although alternative sources may be recommended by friends and family, newspaper ads or community bulletin boards, we encourage you to invest in your children by making licensed child care your first choice. Well, okay, maybe that's better than unlicensed child care. I guess that was that point. But why don't we just invest in our children directly instead of investing our time in making money that we can give to somebody else to invest in our children? We need to invest in our families. But most of all, this is certainly the point that Jesus is trying to make in John chapter 11. We need to invest in eternity. We need to plan long range. Time management experts have often said that we can overestimate what we can get done in a week, but we underestimate what we can get done in a year or 5 years or 25 years. Here's the time that we have to invest in the long-range planning of what happens in eternity. That opportunity is available to us here. Now, let us buy up that opportunity. Let us take time to be holy. We don't usually look to hymn book for time management advice, but that's pretty good. Take time to be holy and invest in eternity. Because you know what? There are only 12 hours in the day. And it may already be the 10th hour or the 11th hour. But while it is yet day, let us invest in our eternal spiritual destiny. If you're here this morning and you have not given yourself into the hands of Jesus Christ, not confessed him, not been buried in baptism and raised up to a new life, you need to do that this morning. If, in fact, we have let ourselves be distracted and hindered either by sins or by just the burdens and hindrances of substituting good things for the better thing of devoting ourselves to our Lord and Savior and his work, let us make a decision right here and now. We're going to invest, whether it's the 10th hour or the 11th hour, in eternity. Let's encourage one another as we stand and sing this song.